Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're all still taking the measure of the global economic downturn we're in. It's clear that it's bad. Australian thinker and environmentalist Paul Gilding says it's worse than you may know, that it's not just the economy, but the global environment that's hitting a wall. Both at the same time. He's an optimist, he says, we'll come out of it, but we'll come out of it changed. This hour, On Point, Paul Gilding on what he calls the Great Disruption. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? The economy and environment off the cliff together. Is our living large lifestyle due for an overhaul? Does the Great Disruption sound too apocalyptic? Or like just the right wake-up call? Later this hour, we will hear from physicist and climate expert Joseph Rahm, who seconds the notion that we're in for a world-rocking change. Joining me now from Sydney, Australia, is Paul Gilding. He's an environmentalist and former executive director of Greenpeace International. He founded the green consulting firm Ecos and chaired the energy conservation firm Easy Being Green. His phrase, the Great Disruption, was featured by New York Times columnist Tom Friedman over the weekend. That piece instantly became the Times' most emailed. Paul Gilding in Sydney, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So what is it, this Great Disruption?
Look, I think it's a dramatic shift. It's a inflection point, as Tom Friedman called it, when the society that we're in, the economy that we're running, starts to make a great change. And I think we'll be looked back on historically as one of the great changes in civilization. And the reason I'm optimistic is because society has a great history of making great changes, but only when the crisis hits. And unfortunately, you know, society, humanity, seems to need a great crisis in order to shift gears and to move into a new direction.
Shift gears, and you're not talking just a little shift. You're talking a great shift, a great disruption. What are you saying is going to be required? You know, there was a stock market rally on Wall Street in New York yesterday, and many people were cheered in this country, hoping, you know, we found the bottom. Maybe we're turning around. Maybe. The economy is on its way back, but you're saying it's not coming back as it was, or if we try, we won't come back.
Look, of course it'd be great if it did. It's not that I wish it wouldn't. It's just that I think the reality is that if you look around at how we've been behaving for a very long time, we are operating a system, a complex system, a system which, you know, we call the economy or society or humanity, call it what you like, but this is a system that operates not in isolation but inside the global ecosystem, the environment. And what we know from the evidence around us from science, but also just from observation, is that system has been running up against its limits for a very long time, getting worse and worse despite the warnings that this point was coming. And, you know, it could be climate change, it can be toxic waste, it can be a whole range of symptoms that you look at. But whatever symptom you look at, the reality is that we are now up against the limit. Now, that can be oil prices spiking, it can be complexity, as we've seen in Wall Street, you know, with products that no one understands. But either way, the system is up against its limits, and what that means is that it starts to shake, it starts to vibrate, it starts to break down. And that is a phenomenon in science as well. You know, whether it's a petri dish of bacteria, whether it's a global economy, any system up against its limits starts to break down or stop growing. And we are now facing a situation where we are going to stop growing, we have stopped growing. And we might come back, as you say, a good day on Wall Street, a bad day on Wall Street, ups and downs, but the broad trend, I think, is now clear. And that is that consumption of material goods in particular, and endless growth in consumption, endless growth in waste, endless growth in material use, I mean, physically can't go on. This is not a philosophical question. This is a physical question. Physics and biology say that you cannot keep growing indefinitely without there being some sort of limit put in place.
Paul Gilding, you're going to have people around the world and in the United States who hear you deliver this message and say, thank heavens, it's time somebody was talking on this scale, talking about these issues, talking about them in tandem. You're going to have others who say, well, of course, this was the former head of Greenpeace. You know, of course he would say this. They almost wish for this. This is the environmentalist dream come true. How do you respond to skeptics? You've been doing it for years, I know, but what do you say to them now?
Look, I wish I was wrong. You know, I mean, unlike most who are forecasting something, I would be delighted with young children in particular to be completely wrong. Unfortunately, the evidence, this is not like a philosophical question any further. This is rational, science-based evidence that says we are up against a insurmountable problem that if we don't change will prevent us from moving forward. So I think, you know, I've heard every argument against it, as you say, for decades. And unfortunately, the evidence is now in, and it's sort of ironic in a way that for environmentalists who've long been argued to be arguing a kind of irrational or philosophical position against rational thought, environmentalists are now on the side of rational thought, and the evidence is very clearly in. And it's actually only those who don't want to believe this who are sort of caught up in this sort of delusional belief in markets as some sort of magic force that will always magically right itself, that have now become quite irrational and ignoring, you know, scientific thought and scientific fact around them, and therefore just, you know, hoping this is not to be true, despite the fact that the evidence now, I think, is incredibly clear and amazingly consistent that we are facing a crisis of quite massive proportions.
Tom Friedman takes your message and boils it down to Mother Nature and Father Greed have hit the wall at once in the Great Disruption. I want to understand exactly, though, what you're saying here. If you're seeing environmental meltdown and economic meltdown at once, are you suggesting that is a coincidence? It's just happened to turn out that way? Or is there an intersection, a cause and effect here? And if there is, draw a circle around it. Help us see it.
Sure. Look, it's a complex system, right? So the system includes the environment. You know, the economy is often quoted as being a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. So we do work in this complex system, and it is always hard to directly attribute any particular crisis to a particular cause. And I would put forward as the argument to support that, for example, the oil price should be an amazingly simple thing to predict and forecast, given it's a single commodity in a relatively clear market. And yet the best brains in the world try and understand that market and cannot predict its price within a factor of 3 or 4. So a dramatic mistake made on a regular basis, in predicting the oil price. So the idea that we can know exactly how the complex economy works globally and how that system works and how it intersects with the global ecosystem is actually very hard to define for any particular incident. So you have to look at it as a system as a whole. And when you look at it as a system as a whole, you say, well, what sort of parameters do we look for? We look for things like food prices, and food prices have spiked enormously in recent years, up and down, but a very consistent increase. Oil prices have gone way up and way down again. We've got the gyrations in the stock market. These are all the systems and the system symptoms that you would look for when a system is up against its limits. And that's what I would say we're facing now. Now, yes, it is true, obviously, that we have some particular problems in the credit market. We have some particular problems caused by a variety of, you know, stupid behaviour by Wall Street cowboys. But nevertheless, that is, I would say, a symptom of the broader issue, which is that we have now designed a system so complex and so difficult to understand, we actually can't predict its behaviour. But what we can say when you look in the system is that it's up against its limits, against its outer parameters of operating, and therefore things are going to go horribly wrong. Now, yes, right now we're seeing incidents in terms of financial markets, but that is, I would say, a broader problem, which is that when you have issues like resource constraint, I mean, was it caused by the oil price spike? Who knows? Was it caused by food increases? Was it caused by imperceptible changes across the economy caused by climate changing? Certainly in Australia, we've had, you know, the worst drought on record, still going on in many parts of Australia, causing significant changes in food production. And that's also a system-wide economic impact. Those sort of issues, I think, are very hard to isolate down to individual particular events, but you can say the system as a whole is behaving in a certain way.
Paul, you know, you say at the end of this that you're an optimist, which suggests you believe humans will rise and respond to this, though it's clear from your analysis that you don't think they've done that sufficiently yet. You say you're an optimist, but a lot of what you're describing here sounds incredibly apocalyptic, the economy and the global environment hitting the wall at the same time. In the letter where you outlined this last summer, scream, crash, boom, too, you headlined it. You're talking about riots and political crisis and upheaval across the world and military intervention, floods and fires. Is this the apocalypse now you're talking about?
Well, look, it's a very, very interesting question, and one that I have struggled with on a personal level quite deeply. I've been having this conversation around the world for the last 4 years, saying this point was coming, because it's very clear to me, looking at the science, that it was coming and it will be here with us for a long time. The challenge is this, that humanity does not respond to major change like this unless there is a crisis. That is the evidence of history, whether you look at World War II, whether you look at the current financial crisis, all these things are, in hindsight, obvious and predictable and clearly coming at us like a freight train. And yet we don't respond until we're in the middle of the crisis. But boy, when we respond, I think, consistently in a spectacular fashion and show how extraordinarily ingenious human society can be. And and the market, let's be clear, the market is actually an example of that, that we are, in one sense, very clever, even though we've made a big fundamental mistake in the design of the market. It is a very interesting, complex, interrelated system that we have designed. And if you look at that example, if you look at the response in World War II, when the U.S., I think the numbers roughly are in 9 months, the U.S. converted 70% of its industrial capacity to the war effort. Now, extraordinary turnaround. Went from a few percent to 37% of GDP being spent on the war effort. So when we put our minds to it, we achieve extraordinary things. And, we are smart as a species, and we are very good at invention. We're very good at creativity. And we're also, importantly, in this particular context, very good at conscious evolution, that we can change our values, our attitudes, our worldview amazingly quickly. And so I do believe, although I am certainly forecasting a very kind of negative period in today's context of material wealth and consumption, forecasting a period where that is going to be a difficult time, we are going to see the best of humanity come out here.
Paul, hold the thought in Sydney, Australia. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about what Paul Gilding calls the Great Disruption. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the view that sees a double whammy in our current global crisis, the economy and the environment, hitting the wall together and demanding global change. They're calling it the Great Disruption. Paul Gilding came up with that phrase. He joins us today from Sydney, Australia, former executive director of Greenpeace International. We'll be joined in a few minutes by American physicist and climate expert Joseph Rahm. Tom Friedman, writing in the New York Times about their views over the weekend, his piece, "The Inflection is Near?" question mark, and the answer seems obvious from his treatments. A great big inflection in the way both the way we address the market and beyond the market, the economy, the way we make our living, the way we interact with the earth. Paul Gilding's in Sydney. He wrote a letter last summer to a lot of friends titled it "Scream Crash Boom 2: The Great Disruption." He quoted Winston Churchill right at the top from 1936 in the run-up to World War II, Churchill saying, "The era of procrastination, of half-measures, of soothing and baffling expedients of delays is coming to its close. In its place, we are now entering a period of consequences." Paul Gilding's suggestion, so are we in a period of consequences. 800-423-TALK is our number. Paul, the Great Disruption, what's it going to be? What's going to have to be disrupted here?
I think imagining a period, a lengthy period, because we have left it quite late, of crisis. Now, that crisis, of course, will manifest different ways in different countries. I think it does involve a sustained period, I would argue, somewhere between 5 and 15 years thereabouts, of a sustained lowering of our standard of living compared to what we have seen in a material sense, right? So I think in terms of the economy, we're not going to grow as fast as we have for a long time. It may come back a bit here and there, but I think it fundamentally will be effectively in a depression, I think, for a period. Now, that's across the economy overall, but in some areas, there will be a spectacular boom. And I refer in particular to the rebuilding phase of new energy sources, of different types of products and different types of business models, which I think will go incredibly well during this period. So I think we are going to see pockets of the economy doing extremely well as we see a way forward from them. And I think we are going to see governments around the world pouring money into the sort of clean, green future. And Tom Friedman refers to this in his column, saying that in Korea, for example, they're really focusing on this area. Of course, the new Obama administration, likewise here in Australia and in Europe as well, we're seeing stimulus packages being used for this area. So I think that's the good news in those areas. There is, however, some negativity in that in a very direct sense of climate impacts that I think we are going to see just by virtue of the nature of physics and science in the area of climate. There is a lag in the system. So I think we are going to see some terrible impacts, and certainly here in Australia, now we've had, you know, we have a lot of bad wildfires in Australia. We've had by far the worst wildfires ever recorded in Australia, and that's, I think, directly a consequence of the warming climate.
Talk about there, you're talking about depression, many years of a lower standard of living, and spectacular boom at the same time. What's the bottom line, though? Is the spectacular boom the sugar to make the medicine go down here? Does it offset the lower standard of living, or are you talking about a different kind of human life on this planet than Americans perhaps and Australians perhaps have known?
Yeah, well, I mean, Australia, of course, is very similar to the US in lots of ways in regards to our consumption patterns. You know, we're unfortunately up there with you per capita in terms of CO2 emissions per person in the world. Not a great badge of courage, really, a great badge of pride. But we are going to see, I think, some really exciting areas, whether or not it overtakes the crash. I mean, that's why I refer to my first letter in 2005 as Scream, Crash, Boom, because I see the crash and the boom happening at the same time. And so I do see enormous opportunity for softening the blow by quickly building the new economy within the old economy. And that's where I think government has to play a very important role to create jobs and create economic activity in this area. I've spent the last decade working inside the corporate sector in the US, Australia, Europe, around the world, in Asia and so on, looking at the opportunities in this area, working with some very large global companies. And I do think there are just enormous economic opportunities in this space, but also personal opportunities for a kind of a reawakening, if you like, of what we value. You know, the reality is we now know that happiness doesn't come from a big car or a big house. You know, they're nice things to have that make us think we're having a good time, make us think we're improving our quality of life. But quality of life comes from family. It comes from friends. It comes from love. It comes from community. It comes from a deeper search for meaning and finding activities of meaning. And that doesn't come from material possessions. So, and we know that. We've known that for a very long time. But we've sort of been deluded by the kind of advertising industry and by consumerism to thinking we can sort of buy our way into happiness. And we know we can't. But you don't really realize that as a society until you hit that wall of having the wealth and finding out it actually doesn't solve our problems at all.
Paul Gilding joins us from Sydney, Australia. He's calling what we're in the midst of, the Great Disruption. We'll be joined in a moment by Joseph Rahm, American physicist. Let's take a couple of callers here first. From Newbury, Vermont, Linda. Linda, you're on the air with Paul Gilding.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Paul, I know you probably are familiar with a movie that a lot of people who are following this movement know about called The End of Suburbia, which is a real wake-up call for people who are not familiar with peak oil. And I learned about that movie about 5 years ago, and my husband and I began to make changes in our lives trying to be more responsible for the impact that we have on the world. Recently, we've helped to start an energy committee in our town, and we've found a book called The Transition Handbook by Rob Hopkins of Totnes, England. And I wonder if you're familiar with that book and about this very positive vision that Hopkins presents of what the world could be like as we descend out of oil dependence into maybe a golden age of sustainability.
A positive vision. That sounds good. Paul Gilding, what do you say?
Look, I don't know the book precisely, but I know the concept and I know the movement you're referring to, and it's a very exciting example where communities can come together and recognize that they can create stronger, safer, and more pleasant communities by focusing on the loss of oil supply and the need to move away from those polluting technologies towards a different future. And I think you're referring there to a great example whereby not only do we not have a lowering of standard of living, we actually have an increase in standard of living as long as we quantify that around more human values rather than just financial throughput of the system.
Redefining standard of living there, you're saying, in the midst of great disruption. Linda, thanks for calling. David in Swainsboro, Georgia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, sir. My question would be, can you relate to the fact that in the 70s, the pendulum was really laid to people who worked and they got a good standard of living. And since then, the pendulum has been moved far away from it to the people who just want greed. And they have used this greed to deceive us. And put up with all this pollution and everything else the man is saying is really right on point with this great, I call it great deception, but he's right. But do we need an oracle revolt to correct this, or can it be done any other way?
David, thanks. Paul, did you catch that?
Yeah, I did. And I think, you know, David's point, I think, is quite clever. You know, the great deception. We've in many ways been deceived that an endlessly increasing standard of life comes from material wealth. Now, let me be clear. I'm not opposed to wealth creation. I'm not opposed to improving the physical quality of our life. There is no doubt at all. If you're in poverty, then increasing wealth to get a decent home, to get a decent form of transport, to have your kids safe, to get a decent schooling, these are improvements in quality of life. So I'm not arguing for kind of a noble, savage view of the world. What I'm saying is once you get to a certain point, that's when the deception sort of kicks in, that you go beyond that, you don't get any happier. And the data is very clear on this, by the way, when you do studies of this, and people have done studies that have shown that once you get beyond kind of a $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year income, in that kind of range, and it varies from country to country, the actual happiness of the community does not increase any further. And that's why I think we have to think about the system. Where does quality of life come from? Quality of life is first of all met by having decent food, decent housing, decent schooling and so on. But once you get that sorted out, you know, quality of life comes from community, quality of life comes from meaning, from a sort of conscious engagement with your society to sort of deepen your experience of life.
Well, so you say, but an awful lot of Americans, and I'm betting Australians too, work very hard to push their incomes beyond that level you're describing there, $30,000, $50,000. I couldn't hear it all, but $30,000, $50,000, $80,000. Many don't, but many really work on that. You know, the caller asks, if you're talking about a revolution to make this new standard the standard.
Correct. Oh, no, I completely recognize the scale of the change, believe me. And it's not like there is right and wrong. We are all part of this system. We are all pursuing that increasing standard of living because the machine around us tells us that's what we should do. So it's not just about, do I want this stuff? It's do I feel better as a human being because I have more stuff than Joe down the road? So the whole system is designed around convincing us that having more will make us happier, will improve the quality of our life. The reality is that it's not. So, you know, we do feel good about having more than the person next door, and that's a human trait. I don't criticise that. It's just the reality of how we are. But that doesn't give us a deeper sense of development. Therefore, it is, as David said, a great deception. It is a belief system that we think is going to work for us, but it doesn't. And of course, that's not going to change because of some philosophical view. The reality and the observation of history tells us that will change when we are forced to change because it actually physically stops working for us. And that's my point about the times we're in now. We are now bumping up against those limits, and therefore the limits are going to come back and bite us with a very direct physical impact.
Paul Gilding, please stand by in Sydney, Australia. We're joined as well now from Washington, D.C., by American physicist and climate expert Joseph Rahm. He's author of Hell and High Water. He was a top official at the Department of Energy's Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in the Clinton administration. He, like you, Paul, was quoted referenced at some length in Tom Friedman's column over the weekend. Joe Rahm, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So maybe we're at a different point than we imagined or some had imagined. Tom Friedman, no wild-eyed environmentalist, but he says in his column, we can't do this anymore. And then he quotes you saying, we created a way of raising standards of living that we can't possibly pass on to our children. You say in your blog recently, climateprogress.org, it's a global Ponzi scheme and we're all Bernie Madoffs. Cut and dried, simple as that. That's it. Over, Joe?
Well, you know, the Ponzi schemes must collapse if, you know, the analogy that I was making to the Ponzi scheme where you pay current investors from the money and wealth of future investors or the next generation of investors is that what we're doing now is living off the wealth of future generations. We're taking their non-renewable resources. We're taking their livable climate, and they won't have it. And you know, to perpetuate the high returns that the rich countries have been achieving, we've been taking more and more of the non-renewable resources, especially hydrocarbons and natural capital, freshwater, arable land, forests, and fisheries, and, of course, the most important non-renewable natural capital of all, a livable climate. And so the next generation can't live and can't generate wealth the way that we have, and the developing nations can't live like Americans. It's simply not possible. There isn't – not only aren't there enough resources, but the climate will be, you know, unimaginably destroyed. And I think that it's important for people to understand that in the last 2 years in particular, the science on global warming has gotten much firmer and much more alarming. And we are on track. If we don't do anything, just business as usual, to warm the globe something like 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and the much of the United States would warm by 15 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century, and sea levels would be 5 feet higher, and then they would rise 10 inches a decade for hundreds of years. So this is not, and a third of the planet could be desert. So this is not a world that we can live leave to our children. So we, you know, I see it as that we have one of two options. We voluntarily and aggressively start changing now, changing the way we use energy and how we use material resources. Mm. And if we do that, we will have to change somewhat. But I think the impacts on most Americans will be very modest compared to what will be forced on the next generation, and not just the next generation, but the science says that if you don't stop global warming and reverse course very soon, you are stuck with a radically changed climate for 1,000 years.
You say, Joe, in your blog, that the adults are not standing up. Does that mean that in your assessment, even in the midst of the economic crisis that everyone is acknowledging now, even with the huge stimulus plan put out there, with elements of alternative energy, cap and trade, and the rest in it, that there's not enough on the table? How much more? How soon do we need?
Well, let me say that I think that the Obama administration has made, you know, has done more in its first, 6 weeks than the country has done in the past 10 years. And it is a very good start. But remember, in order to avert catastrophic global warming, and to deal with the fact that oil is peaking, and we are going to see much higher prices for oil once the global economy rebounds, we need to, the rich countries need to reduce their consumption or the emissions from coal, oil, and natural gas by, let's say, 80% to 90% over the next 4 decades. And so we're going to have to, we have to change the entire energy system of the country. So that's you know, we've started that, and I give the president a lot of credit. But we are going to need much bigger push on renewable energy, much bigger push on energy efficiency, much bigger push on super efficient cars and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. And of course, we're going to need a limiting of carbon dioxide emissions. If this is done voluntarily and intelligently, the impact, like I said, on most people's lifestyles, wealth in this country will continue to rise, but it will become sustainable wealth. Over time, will people, you know, own less junk? On climate progress, I did a blog post where I asked people to tell me what their most unsustainable piece of junk that they owned was. And I think if you go into most people's homes, we own a lot of stuff that just generates no value, but it we own it because we can own it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the view that sees a double whammy in our current global crisis, the economy and the environment hitting the wall together and demanding global change. It's being called the Great Disruption. Paul Gilding came up with the phrase, former executive director of Greenpeace International. He joins us today from Sydney Australia. And from Washington, we're joined by American physicist and climate expert Joseph Rahm. He's author of Hell and High Water, Global Warming, the Solution and the Politics, and What We Should Do. His blog is climateprogress.org. They were both cited, along with others, by Tom Friedman over the weekend in a column talking about an inflection, a great inflection point that we are in the middle of right now. Friedman concludes, we can't do this anymore. And by this, he means an awful lot about our economic lives as we've known them. Let's get a call from New Haven, Connecticut. And Bill, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. I have a tendency to see very complex problems to begin to try to unravel them in the simplest of way. Let's talk about the reverse domino effect. So we all buy, I get it, we all buy lots of T-shirts. We don't need as many T-shirts as we have. So if I am the American consumer and I say, okay, I have enough T-shirts to last me easily, well, at my age, for the rest of my life, so I stop buying. What my question to the specialist is, what is the education component? Because when I stop buying T-shirts, if I represent the American consumer, a lot of those people who are making 50 cents a day in India or whatever are not going to have a job. So where does the education part of this really brilliant articulation of the problem come in?
Bill, let us pick it up. Paul Gilding in Australia, you know, how do you turn the domino effect around? How do you make it go the other way, get everybody on board? If Bill doesn't buy his T-shirt, what about the job in China? And who needs the education here? Who's ahead of whom?
Well, Bill raises a very, very important point, because that's where the kind of great problem we face now is that we have become addicted as a society to a system which requires us to buy T-shirts we don't need. So the political solution in most countries in the last few months has been, everybody, please go out and shop. Go out and buy some more stuff that you don't need with money that you haven't got, and get the economy moving again. I mean, what an absurd idea. Right, so we have got a very fundamental system design problem. Bill's point is an important one, though, which is that we have to transition to a new model. So it does require education of people in Western countries, but also in developing countries, to say, well, hang on, that's not going to work, is it? We can't keep on having our society depend upon a model that is fundamentally stupid and is going to break at some point. Let's break it consciously, as Joe says, and build a new one. And that does require us to say, for example, well, do I need that much stuff? And therefore, do I need to work that much, actually? Do I need the money? Could I perhaps work less and buy less and have a better quality of life and therefore share the material wealth around more, but actually improve the overall quality of my life in the process? That's the education part that we need to get to work on.
Joe, but Paul is describing 5 to 15 years of lowered standards of living. He talks about a depression. At the same time, there's room for a spectacular boom in alternative fuels and so on. I mean, never mind Australia for a minute, or China for that matter, just this country. Can you see politically this country taking on board 5 or 15 years of down economy? What may be great in the long run as we redefine our sense of standard of living, but for right now, it would feel like a lowered standard of living.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is hard to know how this is going to play out in the very near future. I don't necessarily see the collapse coming in 5 to 15 years.
No, he's saying it's here, and it may last that long.
Oh, yeah, I guess I don't know that. I tend to look at this a little different. If we wanted to continue unsustainably on our current path, we could probably do it another 10 to 20 years. But I suspect that by the end of the next decade, by the year 2020, the vast majority of informed Americans and opinion makers will understand that everything that I and Paul said is true, and we will begin what I actually call planetary purgatory, which is this desperate effort to avert the catastrophe. And, you know, the model to keep in mind, I think, and I was just at a press conference where Senator Bernie Sanders used the analogy also, is World War II. When people say, you know, we can't make this change, we changed the entire manufacturing system of this country in about a year during World War II to go to a wartime footing. And we, in 9 months, we went from making 3 million cars a year to making the arsenal of democracy. Well, we need to make the arsenal of sustainability. And yes, there's a lot of stuff that we make now that we're certainly not going to be making in 20 years. It would be nice if we voluntarily, intelligently made this aggressive transition. And you know, to the extent that we have intelligent policies that aggressively pursue jobs in sustainable technologies, then, you know, I think we can avert the worst of the near-term collapse. I confess I am much more concerned about the collapse that I see coming in 20 or 30 years.
Planetary purgatory if we don't get started now, and maybe a little if we get started even tomorrow morning. Michael's calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I'm somewhat dubious. I personally would agree with everything that's being said, but I don't see the American people, you know, seeing really beyond their own situation from one day, 1 week to the next. And I don't really believe that this current administration is still going to be here 4 years from now, let's say, and that science is going to be on the agenda. We lost it for 8 to 10 years under the previous administration, and we've fallen behind. I'm just not convinced. I wish I could be that. You know, the American people, or the other countries in the world, for that matter, would be, you know, having some kind of institutional way of carrying this forward, other than just a hit or miss reaction and me first.
Yeah, Michael, let us pick it up. And Paul Gilding in Sydney, give us a global perspective here first, if you would. I mean, do you see countries, include your own, include the U.S., but beyond that, do you really see people rising to this? You articulate it and frame it, as does Joe, very powerfully. But do you see this being adopted as a worldview by the folks with the power to follow through on these ideas?
Look, I do, and I do not because I think it's going to be a change in consciousness that will happen by itself. It's going to change because we have to, right? All the evidence, and Joe also referred to World War II and the response then. You know, we respond when we have to. We don't respond by voluntarily because we see it coming. And it's a shame. It's a damn shame, frankly, because it'd be a lot easier if we did it voluntarily early. But we haven't, and we're not going to. We're going to change when the system forces us to change, when we see the kind of impact, the physical impact of both the economic decline, but also the climate decline happening around us. And then we're going to respond. And that will require leadership, and we are going to see that. And I think we really need to look at China, Korea, other countries. We're actually ahead of Australia, ahead of the US now, in some of these areas, and pushing very hard. Yes, they're sort of put forward as the great polluters and et cetera, because they're producing the products that we're consuming. So it's actually our pollution, but that's another story. But they're actually changing now very rapidly, and they are, I think, in danger from our point of view economically. We're in danger in the West that they're going to lead in this area and therefore damage us economically in the process. And so we have to actually catch up in some ways to where they're going. So I am very optimistic about that. I'm not optimistic about us responding until we're forced to. But, boy, I'm optimistic about when we start. It's going to be very exciting. And Tom Friedman in his column referred to this occurring in Asia as well, in outside China, in places like Korea, where their stimulus packages are even more biased towards a clean, green future than they are in Australia and the U.S.
Joe Rahm, of course, is not just faceless powers involved here. It's everybody. You're pretty tough in your blog on ordinary people. You've written, it's gotten harder and harder for any of us to pretend that we are innocent victims. You say we basically know we're living off the fortunes of future generations, and we're just doing it anyway. Do you sense a broad change in consciousness? Paul Gilding talks about it, that would fuel a persistent political pressure for the change you and he are calling for?
I don't see the broad change, but I certainly do see the inklings of change, and I think the fact that a mainstream columnist like Tom Friedman would write such a column, you know, as a very good indicator. But look, you know, people don't start the diet and exercise until they have the heart attack. And so, you know, I agree with Paul in that regard. I think all we can do is get the word out. I do find that large numbers of Americans that I meet understand that the lifestyle that America has come accustomed to is not something that everyone in the world can have. And as ethical and moral people, we are going to have to figure out a transition where the very poorest in the world, of which there are, you know, more than a billion, need basic services. And at the same time, you know, Americans, again, I'm not, you know, I agree that we're not talking about going back to an agrarian society here. We are simply talking about living within the means of the planet and not, you know, destroying the future for our children. And one of the points that I make in my blog is that, you know, Bernie Madoff is condemned because he ripped off charitable foundations. We're ripping off our children and grandchildren. So it just strikes me that yes, this is the greatest moral challenge that humanity has ever faced. And it is time for the adults of the world to say, we have no right to destroy a livable climate for the next 1,000 years, for the next 100 billion people to walk the earth. It is, and not only that, again, people, this is not incredibly expensive. I've seen every study that's written on this subject. We are just talking about a few percent of our wealth. And we're not going to throw that wealth, that money down the toilet. We're going to just shift the money that we spend on inefficient polluting stuff into efficient, cleaner stuff and live more intelligently and sustainably. And I completely agree with Paul that there will be no decrease in happiness. The decrease in happiness will come when in 20 years we wake up and your average American realizes what they have done to their children and grandchildren. That's going to be extreme unhappiness, and I work very hard to avoid putting people into that position.
A great moral challenge embedded in a great economic challenge here. Let's get a call from Waynesboro, Georgia, and Rosalind. Rosalind, you're on the air.
Yes, you folks are doing a real good job of covering the issues, but I've got a suggestion for a solution.
Okay.
The stimulus package and these checks that are coming out to everybody to spend, they should take everybody that gets a check should take as much of it as they can, pick out a environmental fund such as Environmental Defense Fund, Nature Conservancy, Arbor Day, you name it, pick it, and donate to it, because all of the monies that they get right now will be put to such great use in helping to get the word through to the people who are making policy.
Rosalind, we got it. So a call there to go straight to the issue with whatever comes out of the stimulus package in your household pocket, and thank you for that. Let me get another right here from Ithaca, New York. Faye, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of Greenpeace for a long time, and I respect their work. And one of the things I want Paul to address, as well as the other guest, is that one of the things that's talked about very little is population growth. And I feel that we've reached capacity for the planet, and that's another serious topic. And, you know, as well as, you know, our consumption, which no doubt is an issue, but also the fact that we, for many, many years, if not decades, we've buried our heads in the sand when people did come out with global warming issues and the issues we're addressing here.
We're hearing that time is over today, but population growth also on the table. Paul Gilding, there's another enormous challenge in a row of enormous challenges here. You've written that you see a great leap forward for humanity coming, maybe required to move to a higher stage of evolution and consciousness. I mean, that sounds almost messianic. Are we up for this?
Look, I think we are, and I don't think we have to see it necessarily as a great, spiritual transformation of moving to a higher plane.
Maybe we should.
That wouldn't hurt, but it doesn't have to be like that. Very simply, if we simply say, what do we really value? What do we really think is important? We think community is important. We think family is important. We think doing meaningful, useful work in our society is important. These are the things that make us happy. And when I refer to a higher level of consciousness, let's just start with that basic stuff that we know now and then move forward from that. But I do think we have to face up to those questions. We have to recognize that our current level of consciousness, which is a very materially focused, short-term, egoic kind of focus, is actually not working for us anymore, right? And it has worked for us in the past, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we have to go back to the caves or back to an agrarian society. But I'm saying it's not working for us now, and therefore we need to move on right now to a deeper level of understanding about what works for us as humanity. And that is not a great leap forward, but it's a good first step forward in where we need to go.
Paul Gilding in Sydney, Australia, a big thinker about the environment, the economy, and how they come together. His phrase, the great disruption, he says we're in the middle of it right now. Paul Gilding, thank you very much for joining us from Sydney.
Thank you.
Joe Rahm in Washington, are we going to do it?
Sure, absolutely. I think, let me put it this way. We can do it. And like I said, sometimes I say it's only money. Compared to what we're going to lose if we don't do it, it's pennies on the dollar. And I don't think anybody wants to look back at the end of their life and I just want to also say that if we
5 seconds,
do this,
Joe.
Let's just say, the answer is we can do it if we are smart.
If we get going. Joe Rahm in Washington, author of Hell and High Water, thank you for joining us. Listeners, good luck to us all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.